Earlier this month, President Iván Duque of Colombia announced a gesture of extraordinary generosity. The country would offer a new protected status to almost 1 million of the undocumented migrants who have in recent years fled the shambles in neighboring Venezuela and sought refuge in Colombia. The new protocol, set to last 10 years, will allow the new arrivals to work, access health and other services, and build themselves something like a normal life. Almost as startling as the move itself is the positive tone in which the Conservative president announced it. Not for Duque any somber Angela Merkel-like, "we will manage." As Duque pitched it, this is as much an opportunity for Colombia as for the Venezuelans Colombia will take in. President Duque's move prompts many questions, which can be substantially summarized as, why don't more governments do this? Is there perhaps a future in which immigration, so often successfully leveraged by cynical populists and xenophobic cranks, can be seen as an asset by both politicians and citizens of host countries? This is the Foreign Desk.
We have received 1.4 million Venezuelan brothers and sisters. Why? Because they are dying of hunger, because they lack of medicine. Some come with frozen bones, without hope. And we have tried to provide them the accompaniment so that they can recover that hope.
President Duque said, look, I'm taking action on this migration problem, but I'm doing it in a compassionate and a strategic and a pragmatic way. Let's get Venezuelan migrants out of the informal economy. Let's get them into the formal economy. They can help us with the COVID recovery program.
Doctors, nurses working in hospitals has certainly opened a lot of eyes to see the valuable contributions that immigrants are already making across Europe.
But that's what the history of immigration shows, that migrants come, settle, and are helpful. And most of the migrants have shown in history that they contribute to their societies.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, by Monocle's Bogota correspondent, Anastasia Maloney. First of all, let's talk not so much about President Duque's decision itself, though we will get there, as the reasons for it. Why has Colombia's government decided to do this?
Yeah, the decision to grant temporary status to about 1 million Venezuelan migrants who live in Colombia was actually a bit of a surprise. This is a right-wing government. It's a conservative government, and people weren't expecting this decision. However, I think that with the Biden presidency, with the Biden's foreign policy focusing a lot on human rights, I think that Colombia really wanted to show the US that it is compassionate about migration. It wanted to get on the same page as the Biden speech on migration. And I think that they decided it was a really good time to bring out what has been called a very compassionate policy on migration. So one of the reasons, I think, what motivated the president was he wants to look good in front of the US, because the US is a major ally to Colombia and a major donor. The US has given Colombia billions and billions of dollars over many years for its civil war and anti-narcotics operations. And I think that it wanted to show that it was a country that was useful and a valuable ally in the region. And it was almost saying, look, you know, we are on the same side of you, even though we are conservative right-wing government. So one big thing was Biden's coming to power. And the other is that I think that President Duque is not particularly popular in Colombia. While he took the pandemic very seriously and Colombia implemented serious and strict lockdowns, the arrival of vaccines has been very slow. They only came last week. And so I think he wanted to gain more points, and the easiest way to do that was abroad. He also wanted to look good in front of the United Nations. There's many United Nations agencies here. And I think one of the reasons why he introduced such a historic policy was to keep them funding the projects that they do in Colombia. So very much a foreign policy, I think, motivation coming out. But it's still a bit of a surprise. People were not expecting this.
So what actually is the policy? Is it a no strings attached residency? You suggested there was some sort of limit or temporary nature to it.
Yeah, so it's for 10 years. And what it allows undocumented Venezuelans to apply for legal status. And it also allows Venezuelans who've got their documents in order to not have to keep on reapplying. So what that means is that basically the estimated 2 million Venezuelan migrants who live in Colombia will now be legal. And that allows them access to health services, to schools and the vaccination program. And I was speaking to Venezuelan migrants about this decision. And really for them, it means so much. It's a massive deal because before, without any documents, you can't even get a mobile phone. Very hard to rent houses if you don't have any documents. So for them, basic things like having a place to live, being able to pay the rent, being able to have a job, is much easier if they've got the documents. So for Venezuelan migrants, it's been a huge welcome.
You said it was a surprise move by a conservative government, but how has the government gone about selling this policy to Colombia?
Colombia's seen for years now Venezuelans living in their cities and in their countryside. And there was this impression that the government wasn't doing anything about it. They were just letting Venezuelans come into the country and no action was taken. And in his speech, President Duque said, look, I'm taking action on this migration problem, but I'm doing it in a compassionate and a strategic and a pragmatic way. And he said, let's get Venezuelan migrants out of the informal economy. Let's get them into the formal economy. They can help us with the COVID recovery program. It's better to have people working legally for us. In fact, they can now pay taxes. The idea is that, you know, economically speaking, I think the government is hoping that they will get more taxes from companies and self-employed migrants who will now, the idea is, be paying taxes because they are had the paperwork to legally be here.
So President Duque is actively trying to sell this as a benefit, possibly even a boon to Colombia, rather than some burden they must tote.
Oh, completely. No, this has been sold as a positive measure for the economy. It's part of the post-COVID recovery. And also there is the sense that, you know, many Colombians will have Venezuelan relatives or they will be married to a Venezuelan. You know, the idea that Venezuelans and Colombians are intertwined is not new. So rather than just ignoring the problem, he said, look, you know, we recognise that Venezuelans have chosen our country as a refuge to settle in, and we will take action and we will make it easier for them to become part of the system, part of society.
So there's no sense of it being any massive cultural adjustment, like, for example, Syrians moving en masse to Germany. This is maybe more like Scottish people deciding to live and work in England.
Yeah, I think so. Also, the language obviously is the same. And also, there's a big historic connection between Venezuela and Colombia, because during the height of Colombia's civil war in the 70s and 80s, millions of Colombians went the other way. Millions of Colombians displaced and migrated to Venezuela. Of course, it hasn't been that easy. There are people who think that there are far too many Venezuelan migrants and that there should be a top and that should be more controlled. And there is anti-migration sentiment. However, it is not that widespread and it is not sort of a political rhetoric that you hear a lot in Colombia.
I mean, it's certainly been assumed to be the case in Europe for a long time and elsewhere that beating up on migrants, especially undocumented ones, sells newspapers and attracts viewers and listeners. You mentioned that this policy announcement had caught everybody's surprise, including presumably Colombia's media. How have they been playing it?
Yeah, so Colombia's media, the two main papers, one is centre-left and one is centre, I'd say, they have supported this measure. They welcomed it. They also taken by surprise. People have been trying to work out exactly what were the motives. But they've all been calling it a welcomed, compassionate and, as I said, pragmatic solution to what was considered a problem. You know, it was considered a problem in the sense that it felt uncontrolled. So there was this sense of how many more people can Colombia take in?
You said earlier that the status that these Venezuelan migrants have been given is temporary for 10 years, and granted that 10 years is an extremely long time, but has the Colombian government been clear on what is supposed to happen after these people have been here for a decade?
No, it hasn't. No, that part no one knows about. I assume that people are hoping that the situation will get better in Venezuela and that people will start returning. However, in the 3 or 4 years that I've been speaking to Venezuelan migrants, I've never met a migrant that wants to return. In fact, if anything, the situation in Venezuela is getting worse. So it doesn't seem that there's a plan in place.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you for joining us. Colombia's offer to recent arrivals from Venezuela poses an intriguing philosophical and political question. Can more governments repurpose generosity to migrants as enlightened self-interest? Might such a mixture of compassion and pragmatism be especially helpful to countries beginning their post-pandemic rebuilds? And, arguably ironically, could it be that conservative governments might be best placed to embrace the idea? Well, to explore this further, I'm joined now by Panu Putvara and Tessa Shishkovitz. Panu Putvara is a professor of economics and director of the IFO Center for International Institutional Comparisons and Migration Research. He joins us from Munich. Tessa Shishkovitz is a historian, UK correspondent for the Austrian news magazine Profil, and author of Echter Engländer, Britannien unter Brexit. She joins us from London. Let's start with what Colombia is doing, this extraordinary gesture it's made to take in this large population of Venezuelans. Panu, I'll ask you first. President Duque of Colombia is saying that Colombia, and this is his quote, without being a rich country, is showing that you can carry out a coherent, responsible, humanitarian, and above all, intelligent migration policy. Do you think that what Colombia is doing fits those definitions?
Yes, definitely.
I mean, is the pitch to stress the benefits of economic migration, do you think that is the right way forward?
So one thing is that for Colombia, there are a lot of Venezuelan refugees in any case, and regularization of their status is a gain both for them and for the receiving society. And in that sense, it is going to deliver benefits also for the native population.
Tessa, the obvious comparison that has been raised, certainly in Europe, was Germany's decision to take in hundreds of thousands of people from Syria, especially, but Afghanistan, Iraq, other places a few summers ago. It's obviously a different situation for all kinds of reasons, in that, to pick two at random, Syria and Germany have a great deal less in common than Venezuela and Colombia, which are literally next door to each other. But does that kind of gesture, that willingness to take in a large population at once, can we assume that it always does pay off in the long term?
I think sometimes when countries decide to basically legalize illegal migrants that are already in the country, it also takes away a lot of problems when you have a lot of illegal immigrants, because you need to, you know, try to deal with them in any case. So what Colombia is doing is sort of solving a problem that they have already in any case. What Germany did in 2015 and Austria and also Sweden, where a lot of these war refugees went, was to open the doors, while some of the European countries said they would not open the doors. So it was a very courageous step by Angela Merkel, who was the driving force behind this, to open the doors. And she would probably not have done this on, you know, thinking about economics as much than on humanitarian terms, which again goes back, of course, in the German history. Angela Merkel is from a generation who did not want to be seen as someone who lets war refugees not over a border to a rich country, similar as the Jewish refugees in the Second World War that fled from the Nazis found closed borders from Switzerland to America. And I think this is, in that case, there are two different cases, because Merkel could have sort of also refused to open the borders, which would have been terrible, I think, because this wave of refugees was already underway. And in economic terms, she certainly didn't think at that point that these refugees would be very useful for the German economy later. But that's what the history of immigration shows, that migrants come, settle, and are helpful. And most of the migrants, the economic migrants, and also the war refugees have shown in history that they contribute to their societies.
Panu, there are a couple of different things going on there. There is that delineation between people we might think of as economic migrants and people we might think of as refugees. Obviously, there is a big overlap between those two as well. But is one of those groupings Has it been shown to be more economically productive and easier to integrate than the other? Is there a noticeable difference between those?
So I would say that when it comes to economic migration, if it's based on job opportunities, it is generating net gains both for the migrants, of course, because otherwise they would not migrate, and to the receiving societies. When it comes to refugees, then the main motivation to take refugees is humanitarian. So it would be unrealistic to expect that the refugees would always deliver economic net benefits. Different countries made very different experiences when it comes to integrating refugees, and this is a very important challenge, especially for European countries.
Just to follow that up, Panu, are there countries, European or otherwise, that have done noticeably better at that than others?
I would say that Canada and the United States have been much more successful in labor market integration than Western European countries in general. Also, if it comes to, say, Australia, New Zealand, they take refugees who have been already recognized, or quota refugees who have been already recognized by the United Nations, and then those who are taken and get the legal status have been successfully integrated.
Tessa, if it is the case that on balance, certainly in the long run, that economic migrants and indeed refugees do tend to be a net benefit to the countries they arrive in, why are so many governments still so reluctant to make that case? I think that's the thing that has arrested the attention about Colombia's gesture, and it's certainly the reason we're doing this episode, is that President Duque has not said that this is a terrible burden that we must carry. He's pitching this as an opportunity. He's saying this will be a good thing for Colombia.
In certain countries, I think, who are immigrant countries and societies by their origin, like the United States of America, for example, it was sort of part of the self-image of the new nation that you could come and make it there as a refugee. You didn't have to be American for generations, because at the beginning, there were no Americans for generations. In other countries, like in Austria, for example, which has a very mixed bag when it comes to immigration, because, you know, from the Habsburg Empire on, Austria was built from very different nations with very many different languages. And that was a very fruitful period in the history of Vienna as a capital of all these immigrants that came later because of National Socialism. Again, this sort of narrowed very much to an extent that today we would think it's almost impossible to reimagine this time. But then again, we have now a prime minister who has refused this fall, when the refugee camps in Lesbos first were burned down and then were flooded, to take even the children who are stranded there for years already without any proper education or any proper hope for getting on and out of there. And there was, for example, a civil society initiative in Austria where people came up with 3,188 safe places within the civil society for these children to find a place outside of these camps. You just needed to go pick them up, bring them there. They would have been taken care of. And the prime minister, Sebastian Kurz, refused. So you ask yourself, why does he do that? Why is he not seeing the opportunity? Probably because he was voted in by far-right and right-wing voters, and he doesn't want to leave them. Xenophobia is a very tempting political tool if you want to get elected, especially in those years that followed the big refugee wave that came in 2015. People felt overwhelmed. There was a lot of fear in the population that this would happen now, like every 2 years, which would be a difficult thing to integrate so many newcomers in the society. But this is what you can see, that there are far right, but also right wing conservative politicians who thrive on xenophobia. And that's why they keep doing it.
Panu, as we've been discussing, there are those countries which I guess have a cultural mindset more open to immigration. And those are countries, you know, as we've been discussing, Canada, the United States, Australia, which all have in common the fact that apart from the indigenous peoples of all of those countries, everybody there is either an immigrant or descended from immigrants. Is it possible, though, to get past a cultural resistance in, say, European countries by constructing systems around migration that make the process easier and make the host countries more receptive to it?
Yes. So if I'm thinking about, so I'm from Finland and I live in Germany, in Munich, and more than one in five people living in Munich are immigrants. I have an immigration background and it works very well. So I would say that if in general, if it comes to big European cities, most of them are also immigrant cities. And there are differences how well the integration has succeeded in different cities, but there are a lot of success stories. Then there are also examples on then the immigration has not succeeded well. So if I think about, say, French banlieues or some suburbs in Belgium, the immigrants are very much segregated from the rest of the society. Those are the areas that we have problems with unemployment, radicalization, and then also far-right voting on the part of the native population.
But just to follow that up, Panu, do we yet understand, and maybe focus this on a European context, whether there are particular policy prescriptions which do work or don't work in terms of avoiding those problems you were mentioning?
So I would say that what is really important is that for those countries where English is not the first language, which is most of the Europe, it's very important to invest in the language learning of immigrants to help integration, to provide education, also to make labor market integration as easy as possible. So those countries which have succeeded in integrating immigrants have typically rather flexible labor markets and easy to enter also for low-skilled people. And this is a challenge then for, can say, traditional European welfare states in which the salary level and social protection mean that many of the low-skilled jobs are just crowded out. They are too expensive and that makes it very difficult for less skilled immigrants to find those initial jobs.
Tessie, you were mentioning earlier that the temptations of xenophobia for anybody seeking office, especially if they are seeking it from the right. And this does bring us to one of the other interesting aspects of what Colombia is doing, is that this is a nominally conservative government making this huge gesture in favour of immigration. Is there an argument, a perhaps ironic counterintuitive one, that conservative governments are actually better placed to make this case? For two reasons. One is that they already have the market cornered on national identity, protecting borders, security, etc. And also that they can pitch it as a purely economic case, just saying that this will make everybody here ultimately wealthier.
Well, we're living in a time where it's already the question, conservative or progressive governments, what does it actually mean? Look at the government here in the UK. You know, we had a Brexit politician in Boris Johnson who has a large majority now in the House of Commons. You would think that he can do basically whatever he likes. He was in his previous incarnation as a mayor of London, not opposed to immigration. He could now turn his ship in this direction of more liberal immigration policies, but he has appointed a Home Office Minister with Priti Patel, who made such hard rules and introduced such laws against migration now that her own parents would not be able to immigrate anymore as they did before she was born. So I think in a way you could always, it depends more than on the politics. I think it depends also on the courage of these leaders. Because if you emphasize, as you said before, the opportunities that people bring, if you emphasize good examples for integrated, successful migrants after one generation. And now, for example, we have beautiful stories coming from Germany of Syrian refugees who within these 5 years have made their existence. I mean, half of them are in jobs by now. That's maybe not enough, but you can really find very good examples of how willing people were, although they came from Syria and from a Muslim country and, you know, from different sets of also social classes and all this, but a lot of them made it. And one of the most beautiful stories is the one of Özlem Türeci and Ugo Sahin, the two founders of BioNTech in Germany. It's a German company. They are Turkish immigrants. He came when he was 4 years old from Turkey with his parents, and she was born in Germany. And they are sort of among the most innovative and most successful, not only scientists, but also entrepreneurs. And that's exactly what a country like Germany needs now. And if you sort of emphasize these biographies, then you also, in a pandemic like ours, open maybe the mind of voters who have voted for parties that were against immigration to think like maybe we can sort of, you know, find some good in it. So it's a very much a question of courage of leaders, and also of not a short-sighted political agenda, but one that looks ahead for 20 years. Because if we don't have enough immigration in Europe, then we will simply die out because we don't have enough babies ourselves, so to speak.
Panu, Tessa there mentions a couple of the great recent disruptions. As Europe recovers from Brexit and the world recovers from COVID-19, is there an opportunity there for a government that wanted to pitch immigration as an opportunity, saying, look, we need to rebuild, we need to rethink, and we need new people to do that? Do you think that at a moment like this, where everything does seem in play and that things could change, that there is an opportunity there for a government to take a new approach on immigration?
I definitely see that there is a great opportunity. In addition to the Turkish couple that founded BioNTech, and there is also a lot of people who are working in healthcare sector, so doctors, nurses, working in hospitals, and I think that this has certainly opened a lot of eyes and hearts to see the valuable contributions that immigrants are already making across Europe, and also highlighting the potential gains from better integration of immigrants, and also making a case for especially work-based immigration.
I mean, Tessa, as an EU citizen here in the UK, obviously Brexit has seen quite a lot of Europeans go home. I think COVID-19 has probably also had that effect as well. It certainly will have discouraged more people from coming. Do you perceive any hope that the United Kingdom in particular might be about to realise that you don't really know what you've got until it has gone, especially in the context of the NHS, as Panu suggested, which relies massively on staffing from elsewhere?
Well, we have noticed that in the public opinion now, the threat of EU migrants has disappeared. For one, because there's no freedom of movement anymore and people cannot come as easily as they did since 2004, when sort of a lot of immigrants came from within the EU, from Poland and other Eastern European countries who have been also turned out to be very successful immigrants, one might want to add here. But now, of course, Brexit has been done, so the subject is gone from the headlines, and it has turned a little bit already to the contrary, because of course we now feel that not only people left after the Brexit vote because they didn't feel welcome anymore, but because people cannot come now anymore, then the usual influx that goes to the hospitals of high-skilled workers like nurses and doctors, but also the low-skilled workers that came for seasonal work, flew in on charter planes, often Bulgarian and Romanian in the last years, and then worked on agricultural farms to pick fruit and stuff like that. So there's a shortage of this. Clearly now we see the reports, and I wonder what effect it has on hardcore Brexit voters who sit somewhere in middle England and they have not had, you know, haven't felt a lot of the effects of this because they sit in nice villages and they reinforce probably their opinions with their friends. So I guess that this feeling that the EU immigration was bad for Britain will survive the first wave now of problems that arise from having stopped the EU migration. Yeah? If you look at the opinion polls now, you also at the topics that come up. So there's a lot of talk about the fishermen now that are being upset because they're going bankrupt because they can't export their shellfish to the European Union anymore. Is anyone blaming Brexit or Boris Johnson for it? At the moment, I think they're blaming the European Union for being so tough or mean or whatever. So it's very tough to overcome xenophobic fears. And I think it takes a long and a complex approach to break this down, which needs to also come from the government. And this government here so far has not done anything.
Well, Panu, just as a final thought, is it often just a matter of time? Is it invariably the case that after two or three generations of a particular group of people being in a new country, it ceases to seem all that weird or interesting that they're there and nobody really remarks on it anymore?
I would say that so far that has been the case. So that also if you look at the United States, there have been prejudices against subsequent groups of immigrants from Ireland, from Italy, from Eastern Europe, and Germany also at some point. So it is something that is now fortunately a thing on the past, and subsequent generations have integrated successfully. And I think that European countries have also great possibility of achieving the same as long as we ensure that immigrants have a possibility, also refugees have a possibility to get educated and to get integrated into the labor market, because that's a central part of integration.
Panu Puttavaara and Tessa Shishkovits, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolene Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer, and special thanks this week also to Rhys James. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.